Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. One of the most intelligent men I've had the privilege of knowing is with us as our first guest. His name is Lieutenant Colonel Tommy Waller, United States Marine Corps Reserves. He is in his civilian life and day job, the Director of Special Projects at the Center for Security Policy, working in particular on the security of our infrastructure. And he has recently penned a piece at securefreedom.org that represents, I think, a very important assessment of a problem that has gotten, frankly, all too little attention, it seems, namely a highly intrusive, successful, and potentially very dangerous penetration of government agencies' cyber systems by apparently Russian hackers and perhaps others, maybe the Chinese as well. Let's just quickly recap, Tommy, what we know about this SolarWinds hack.
Well, Frank, the attack is one on our supply chain. When we say supply chain, there's a lot of different ways to define that. In this case, it is vendor, a contractor that provided the IT services to hundreds of corporations and government agencies. And now the technique used by the Russian hackers is not uncommon, where they would go after a contractor as sort of the weak link to then get into and move laterally into other areas of interest. And of course, as you mentioned, now the same IT contractor appears to be exploited by the People's Republic of China. We've seen this before with China's breach of the Office of Personnel Management. This technique of going after the government contractor that has access and then moving in. This is what the Russian hackers did. The results of which and the damage to it, it appears, we're probably not going to know. It's, I think, very extensive.
Just to put a fine point on it, we're being told that it's more than 160 different agencies and some 600,000 federal employees that have been affected, to say nothing of these private sector entities. Tell me, that's staggering. I mean, it makes the OPM penetration by the Chinese pale by comparison, I think.
Yeah, and Frank, what you just mentioned is what we think the Chinese have done in their penetration of the National Finance Center, or NFC. That organization performs all those payroll and administrative functions for the agencies you just mentioned.
So that's just a subset. Yeah. Wow.
Right. They initially came in, it appears, after the Department of Agriculture, which, I mean, that's reasonable for the People's Republic of China to be paying close attention to that department, given all of the emphasis on our agricultural products and trade negotiations. Now, in terms of the Russians, Frank, what we believe is that, you know, they made the initial penetration of SolarWinds, and we think it was because of an objective to go after cloud architecture. So many of our government agencies are moving to the cloud, and we know that the CIA, for example, has contracted 5 IT companies to have them compete over the task of taking care of their cloud architect. And at least 4 of those 5 companies were clients of SolarWinds. And so we think that that's particularly what the Russians were after, was a method to get to those cloud, really more so for espionage and information purposes than maybe kinetic acts on infrastructure, which of course is something the Chinese seem to be bent on at the moment.
Well, let's pivot to that, Tommy, because a lot of the work that you do at the Center for Security Policy has to do with trying to protect our infrastructure. You've been leading very impressively this Secure the Grid coalition that we started, a decade or so ago, I guess. When you look at these sorts of adversaries and their cyber capabilities to get inside our wire, as it were, in this case, literally, our electric wires, tell me, on top of another story that we talked about earlier with one of our colleagues, Michael Mabee, that they've also, it seems, got equipment, transformers in some cases, in the case of the Chinese, hundreds of them, as well as other gear and software that is already inside our electric grid. President Biden has suspended an order that was issued by Donald Trump saying, you know, we don't want more of this stuff to be put, we don't want foreign equipment put inside the grid. It's already there. Talk a little bit about that and the implications of it as you see it, especially against the backdrop of what we've just discussed.
Sure, absolutely. So, you know, as we discuss the solar wind tax and you know, the sort of normal approach to cybersecurity, we would be having these cyber warriors try to defend our network, prevent such penetrations when they find them, try to uproot the malware. You can equate that to maybe what the French did with the Maginot Line. What China's done, Frank, is they've just bypassed the Maginot Line. So instead of worrying about all of the cybersecurity emphasis on network, they just build the equipment and they provide it at a price well cheaper than what it can be afforded elsewhere. And then as our industry buys it, they've just bypassed that Maginot Line. They can then attack us from behind the wire. And so that's through techniques like installing backdoors, hardware backdoors, and things like transformers. I mean, this is such a big deal that the U.S. government seized a 500,000-pound transformer that was ordered for probably a pretty important place somewhere in the grid. They seized it at the Port of Houston and under a federal escort transported it to Sandia National Laboratory where it's being ripped apart and inspected. We don't know what they found, but that's a big deal. A company orders these transformers, you know, a year out in some cases. There's somewhere in the grid that doesn't have this transformer because of this concern. So,
and more to the point, according to Mike, maybe there are 200 to 300 of them that are already somewhere in the grid, possibly with those back doors. So, Tommy, I know that one of the things that you've been working on and are expecting to deliver today is a letter to the Biden administration urging them not to dispense with the Trump executive order, but to improve it. Talk a bit about that and specifically what the recommendations of the Secure the Grid Coalition are going to be.
Sure. Yeah. So President Biden, when he signed his executive order on Inauguration Day, he suspended Trump's previous executive order. For 90 days, he's giving the Secretary of Energy and Director of OMB an opportunity to decide whether to recommend that a replacement order be issued. And so just yesterday, you know, the nominee for Secretary of Energy, former Michigan Governor Jennifer Granholm, was nominated to go to the full Senate for consideration. We think this needs to happen as soon as possible. That clock is ticking. And so what we're doing, Frank, is we're putting together a joint letter that's going to have a ton of evidence to show that the executive order originally signed by President Trump, that's been suspended by President Biden, that she and her colleagues must decide whether to replace, ought to, of course, be replaced and strengthened significantly. And so we anticipate getting this to her as soon as possible. And we're encouraged by, you know, the one response, the one question that was asked during the hearings under the Senate Energy Committee by Senator Lisa Murkowski of Alaska. It was a question about solar winds and security. And Michigan Governor Granholm's response, she said, quote, "We have to harden our electric grid for protection of our energy system." So we want to keep her to her word, but we've got less than 90 days for those words to turn into action. And it's our Secure the Grid Coalition that wants to make sure that we prompt that action, Frank.
We appreciate so much your leadership in this regard, Tommy, and that of the coalition. It's vitally needed, and she's absolutely right. We do need to protect the grid against all enemies, foreign and domestic. Thank you, Tom. Come back to us again soon with updates on all of this, if you would. Next up, we will speak with Robert Spencer about developments involving the enemy within, specifically the question of whether there are Islamists among them. That and more straight ahead.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
We're back, and it is always a pleasure to say we are joined by Robert Spencer, a man who has distinguished himself as an author, as an essayist, as an analyst, and as a commentator about the problem of Sharia supremacism, a term that I think best describes the phenomenon that compels jihad and the efforts to impose upon the non-Muslim world the dictates of the doctrine of Sharia. He is the director of Jihad Watch, a project of the David Horowitz Freedom Center, the author of, well, I think it's now over a score of books, including The Politically Incorrect Guide to Islam, and most recently a book about mass migration in Europe, a model for the U.S., that is published by the Center for Security Policy Press, for whom he is, I'm pleased to say, a senior fellow. Robert Spencer, welcome back to Secure Freedom Radio. Always good to have you, sir.
Always good to talk to you, Frank. Thank you.
You have followed, in the course of your work at Jihad Watch, with great care, Robert, I know, the efforts that were made during the Obama administration to accommodate the demands of, well, often I think Muslim Brotherhood activists and front groups, to deflect attention from the threat that's real and arguably growing in this country of Sharia supremacist violence, or the aspirations for jihad here, onto what was then called violent extremists. And a particular focus was placed, thanks to the work of Muslim Brotherhood folks on the Department of Homeland Security Advisory Committee, to specifically look at people who, you know, revere the Constitution, and veterans, and gun owners, and, you know, right to life activists and the like. When you look at what we are going through now with the Biden administration, does this seem as though that particular phenomenon has now been put on steroids and risks really deflecting again our national attention in ways that could leave us exposed to very real problems by focusing on ones that are not so real?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And of course, Frank, this movement, this initiative gained a tremendous impetus with the storming of the Capitol on January 6th, the details of which are still murky, but of course is being blamed on former President Trump and his supporters, to the degree that a former top CIA official, Robert Grenier, recently said that we have to hunt down these people as ruthlessly as we hunted down Al-Qaeda and ISIS. And much more disquieting than even that is that he says, even at the seeming height of the crisis immediately after 9/11, there really weren't that many members of Al-Qaeda in Afghanistan. And the thrust of our campaign there was, yes, to hunt down Al-Qaeda, but primarily to remove the supportive environment in which they were able to live and to flourish. Now, the implication is clear. If he's going to remove the supportive environment in which these supposedly violent right-wingers move and flourish, he's going to essentially be cracking down on political dissent in the United States and criminalizing it to the degree that only the far-left agenda that the Biden administration represents will be able to be heard in the public square.
Now, this is really chilling, especially given that the people who are being implicated for having supported Donald Trump or supported his concerns about electoral integrity or supporting his commitment to our constitutional freedoms and the like may constitute roughly half the population. And it really raises a very profound concern. We'll be talking more about it shortly, I know, with Jeff Nyquist, of, well, inciting a kind of civil war inside this country. Do you think it could come to that?
Yeah, I think it could. But unfortunately, right now, the power is all on the other side. And so for a civil war, you have to have two sides that can actually fight. And when you have one side controlling the presidency, the Congress, the establishment media, the educational system, on and on and on.
The military.
I think that they are, yeah, the military as well, of course, with Mattis actually saying, former General Mattis actually saying that he hoped Biden would discard the America First policy, which I think is just astounding. What other country should the U.S. president be putting first?
We'll be hearing more about that, I'm sure, in the course of the day today. We'll have more on it tomorrow as Joe Biden lays out his foreign policy agenda at the State Department. But Robert Spencer, I did want to ask you about, in addition to sort of this policy direction, the old Reagan line about personnel is policy seems to be very much affecting what is likely to come out of this administration. And I wanted to ask you in particular about an individual by the name of Maher Bitar, who has been appointed to be the head of the intelligence sort of liaison role between the intelligence community and the White House for the National Security Council. What do we know about this chap Bitar, and what does such an appointment portend as you see it?
Well, he was an executive board member for the Students for Justice in Palestine, which is a viciously anti-Israel group that has links to the Muslim Brotherhood. He is a BDS activist
as well, I think.
Yeah, no doubt about it. And he doesn't have any intelligence background, so it's really striking that he's going to be the director of intelligence for the National Security Council. I believe that's his title. In any case, it's just it's a fulfillment of Biden's promise that he would put Muslims at every level of his administration, and a fulfillment of my prediction in one of our earlier discussions, Frank, that these people would be all Muslim Brotherhood linked and Sharia supremacists. So it's appalling, really, that he's going to be in this position of power and influence, but it's not at all surprising. And the effect of it will be to deflect attention away from the very real jihad threat and to intensify efforts to criminalize legitimate political opposition in the United States.
This is, again, of a piece with what we were talking about earlier, Robert, but it kind of puts it on steroids. If you have a guy who has a track record of affinity for, well, I think it's fair to say, sort of Sharia supremacism over Israel and over others in the non-Muslim world, not only having access to the most sensitive intelligence information in the country, but perhaps being a filter for what is done with that information inside both the National Security Council and perhaps in the president's own office as well. This is a profoundly distressing development, I think. Maybe not surprising, as you say, but still very worrying. This is happening at a time, Robert Spencer, that you at Jihad Watch, which people can find at jihadwatch.org, are chronicling developments in Western Europe in which governments there are beginning to realize mistakes that have been made by their countries, by their governments, in turning a blind eye to sort of the rising influence and, in some cases, power of Muslim Brotherhood-backed groups and communities. Talk a bit about what we're seeing there and whether it perhaps should be seen as a cautionary tale for us as well.
Well, there's no doubt that France is, I think, a little bit farther down the road than we are. And so what we can see there, we should take as instructive. After the beheading of the schoolteacher Samuel Paty for holding up a cartoon of Muhammad in front of his class, the French government has reacted more strongly and vowed to root out political Islam, whereupon Muslim governments around the world, notably that of Turkey, have condemned the French, said they were Islamophobic, and demanded that the UN and other entities act to halt these measures. And so this is the battle for whether it will be even possible for them to stand up against Sharia and Islamization, or whether they're going to have to accept them in the name of anti-racism and multiculturalism. But it's interesting to note that Marine Le Pen, who has called for an outright ban on what she calls totalitarian, murderous, Islamist ideologies, she is higher in the polls than she's ever been. And so the story isn't completely written in France yet.
Well, this will be one of the areas that we will be looking to you for additional reporting and updates, needless to say, Robert Spencer. Let me turn to one other place where we're watching the Biden foreign policy team make some very troubling approaches to one of the most dangerous of the Sharia supremacist operations in the world, and that would be the mullahocracy of Iran. We expect to hear in the course of President Biden's remarks today some discussion of the reopening he hopes to forge with the Iranian regime. Your thoughts on the advisability of that, Robert, and where it might lead us?
Well, I hope that his team is going into this with their eyes open and with some vestigial sense of working for American interests, because the Iranians, ever since he was elected, have been bolder than ever, have been issuing threats out of destruction. They even said, Rouhani, the president of Iran, even said that the coming administration, that is the Biden administration, will bow before the Islamic Republic. And the appeasement policies that Obama implemented and that Biden apparently wants to bring back are only going to feed this aggressiveness and cause great suffering for the people of Iran and others around the world.
Yeah, the danger is, of course, that it will not be just repressing their own people that will be in store for us as a result, but indeed terrible threats to the rest of the world as Iran does, I'm afraid, realize its nuclear ambitions. Robert Spencer, so much more to talk with you about. I hope we'll visit with you again very soon. In the meantime, thank you for your extraordinary insights today and for the great work you do at jihadwatch.org. I know you keep it up, and I know you'll come back to us soon. Next up, we'll speak with Jeff Nyquist about the lessons of the Spanish Civil War for our own time and more. Straight ahead.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back, and a special welcome to J.R. Nyquist, one of our regulars here at Secure Freedom Radio, I'm very pleased to say, an extraordinarily thoughtful essayist and analyst of the strategic developments of our time and their implications for all of us. You can follow him at jrnyquist.blog and also through some of his writings at places like Epic Times and, of course, his books, the most recent of which is The Fool and His Enemy. He is always welcome here. And Jeff, I'm very anxious to catch up with you about a new post at your site, jrnyquist.blog, entitled The Road to Civil War. Let's talk about that.
Yeah, well, of course, in 1930, the Spanish Civil War began to form under the provisional government. In 1931, it was formed, and it was formed mainly by the left. Because of the Primo de Rivera dictatorship, which was a conservative dictatorship, a very mild authoritarian regime, the right wasn't really organized. They had relied on the dictatorship. There had not been political activity. The left was quite agitated, and they had formed powerful groups. And so that republic was their instrument. They made the rules, they ran the show, and so the first government was theirs. And as soon as that government was initiated, the left started to riot. In fact, the first couple weeks of the Spanish Second Republic, it rioted and killed 23 people on the right. And the people they targeted were conservatives. They also liked to burn Catholic churches, kill priests. And of course, the right did start to organize. But this pattern of violence, as you know, it's very similar to what we've seen with Antifa and BLM. It grew from 1931 on, and you had the election of 1933 finally comes along, and you have the left actually saying, when the right wins the election, saying, oh well, we should change the rules ex post facto so they don't quite win it. And of course they used the rules to try to block the right from power. They couldn't entirely do it. But they excluded the largest conservative party from power, the Catholic Party, which was known as the CEDA party. And of course, they started rioting when basically a center government, not really a right-wing government, came to power. In 1934, there was a massive insurrection. And then when that failed to intimidate the right sufficiently, and three Catholic ministers were appointed, they did another one. And to show you how horrific this got, they derailed trains, they destroyed bridges, they murdered 100 priests, they burned, they looted, in fact, 1,500 people were killed in October 1934. And 15,000 people had to be arrested.
Okay, so let's tie this into what you are forecasting may be in the works according to this playbook, if I can call it that, by the left here in the United States. It seems as though, you know, yes, there were those riots in the summer and fall, and there have, I guess, been some. They've not been much reported on since Joe Biden came to office as well. Connect the dots for us as you see it.
Well, whenever something happens politically in the country that the left doesn't like, they take to the streets on the slightest pretext, and they start showing this muscle that they developed. And what happened in the Spanish Republic was the authorities being so, the government being so, even when you had right-wing people in power, the government's still pretty left-wing. That is, the officials, the people carrying things out.
What one might call the deep state these days.
The deep state. And so it's like one typical thing is that you'd have left-wing rioting, and they go and they'd arrest right-wing people, right, after the left-wing rioting.
So a similarity here would be the tendency to blame, at the moment, those who are Make America Great supporters or Trump supporters, the villains, the insurrectionists, the domestic terrorists, as some would have it, rather than the people who have been engaged in, no kidding, massive violence and terrorism now for months in this country. Is that a parallel that you would draw?
Yeah, that seems to be it. They also would throw the word fascist around. The fascists in Spain were so small, the Falangists were so small at that point that they weren't even worth noting. It's sort of like the Proud Boys are threatening to overthrow the government, you know, and that's why we have to have all these troops in Washington when you've just had a summer of rioting and it wasn't the Proud Boys, you know.
So, Jeff, as we look at how this plays out, I'm reminded of something that a mutual friend of ours, Connie Elliott, has talked about as a means of trying to attain and exercise power by vilifying the other. And a sort of trajectory that she has described is that it begins with dehumanizing and goes forward from there to denying those who've been dehumanized certain rights. And then the next sort of increment is that you begin actually incarcerating people who you've dehumanized and denied certain rights on the grounds that they represent some terrible threat. And then you may even, if these things take their full course, as we've seen in Nazi Germany, of course, as we've seen in other communist nations or totalitarian states, mass murder. Are you seeing signs, at least of the early stages, of some of that kind of treatment? And does it portend that this could conceivably go, you know, the full distance towards horrific mistreatment of large numbers of Americans?
Well, what really strikes me is this mistreatment in the case of Spain took place over a period of years in which the government would abuse the people, you know, you could say oppress them, take away their rights, try to take away their right to vote, for example, and all the while be using a mob to keep them intimidated. And these people were the most law-abiding people in the country. They weren't doing the rioting. They weren't opposing the government in an illegal way. And yet the people that were doing the illegal things were getting away with it in a large part. And it culminated
because they were aligned with the government, I guess it's fair to say, right?
Yeah, because they were aligned with the government, or even when the government, in the case of Trump here in America, or the right-wing government that came in, or it was really a center-right government that came in 1933, that they basically, that government was just weak and easily overrode by, in that case, the president. In our case, you know, we've got the Congress, they impeached President Trump. But it culminated in Spain. It culminated in the election of 1936, which was basically a fraud. Nobody knows what the count was. The left just simply set up an electoral commission, abrogated the votes of entire provinces, took away, members of parliament and replaced people on the right with people on the left. and just started to govern in an autocratic, arrogant way, so much so that the Second Republic was later described by a Spanish historian as an undemocratic democracy.
Some of this does sound eerily familiar, I have to say. I pray God that it's not going to go down this road to an ultimate horrific bloodletting. At the time, of course, Jeff, this was considered to be something of a proxy war by the communists of the Soviet Union supporting the left in Spain and the Nazis and Italians of very much a totalitarian stripe and arguably of the left as well, but in this case supporting Franco, the leader of the right. How does that change the calculus here? Are we seeing outside forces trying to encourage some of this domestic instability and turmoil and possible, you know, terrifying tragedy unfolding in our own country?
Well, there may be that in the case of the left, just as in Spain. But as in Spain, there was no real, you know, fascist or Nazi involvement until the Spanish Civil War broke out. And of course, it was the emotion. You know, the right was very law abiding. They didn't. And you know, if you were looking at America now, and you'd say these people won't do anything. You know, nobody's going to do anything to the left. And that was in Spain.
The MAGA movement, for example. Yeah, here.
Right. The MAGA movement is like, they're law abiding. They're not going to do anything. And what happened in Spain was that the most prominent right wing politician was kidnapped and murdered, shot in a police van. And this murder was a catalyst. The whole country said, we're dead whether we revolt or not.
Jeff, this is a subject to which we will return with you. I appreciate your historical study as well as your dot connecting. And it is a prime example of something we want to avoid, if at all possible, in this country, needless to say. Thanks for your time today, Jeff Nyquist. Check his work out at jrnyquist.blog, and we'll talk with you again very soon, Jeff. Next up, we will be speaking with Kevin Freeman. We'll take stock with him on economic warfare in the United States and more right after this.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back. It's time for our visit inside the economic war room with its proprietor, Kevin Freeman. He is the host of a television program of that name at Blaze TV. You can find out more about it at economicwarroom.com. He is also the author of a couple of terrific books, Secret Weapon and Game Plan, and a prolific resource for all of us on matters involving our economic interests and how adversaries of this country are seeking to undermine them as part of a larger strategy for taking us down. Kevin Freeman, it's always good to have you with us. Welcome back.
Thank you, Frank. Always good to be with you.
I know your new program at Economic War Room, Kevin, deals with a topic that we've touched on from time to time. You understand extremely well the economic warfare implications of America's currency ceasing to be considered the reserve currency of the world. And I'm interested in talking with you about the prospects that this new stimulus bill that is being bruited in the Congress, and some say it'll be a $2 trillion exercise as it has in the past, That seems to be the preference of the Democrats, particularly the Biden administration and its friends on the Hill. And at the low end, perhaps something on the order of $600 billion more that the Republicans seem to be pushing out of the Senate, particularly. Give us your sense of where this is headed, but more to the point, what the implications of it might be for the value of the dollar and its special status as the reserve currency of the world.
Yeah, well, Frank, we're approaching $30 trillion in debt. You know, a dozen years ago when I started warning that there would be a push to remove the dollar as the reserve currency, people laughed, and most of the world believed that that was impossible. Now, a few people in Washington believe it's impossible, but most of the world understands that the dollar is in a long line of former reserve currencies. It is today the most important currency in the world, but there are forces actively at work to undermine that. Outside the United States and inside the United States. And one of the ways you can destroy reserve currency is you just continue to spend money and print money so that there is so much of that currency out there that it loses its value and people no longer want to use it to trade for international goods or for oil or whatever. And the Biden administration policies, and especially if we add another $2 trillion in debt, hastens that day very quickly.
And hastening that day translates into a sort of, well, free fall for our economy, does it not, Kevin? And you know, tease again out that prospect. I think most of us looking at this are taking a very short-sighted view that it's just a question of getting some more money in the economy, getting some more money into the stock market and the like, and that it won't have untoward consequences. But how serious would the effect be should the United States literally have to have others determining essentially what interest rates we can charge for our debt rather than being able to set that ourselves?
Well, if you step back and you think of it from a household perspective, imagine that you have a decent income, but you spend a good percentage more than you take in. So let's say you take in $300,000 a year and you spend $400,000 a year. I mean, you've got a great income. You're among the highest income earners in the planet, really. But you're spending every month more than you're taking in. Now, imagine that you've got this massive debt that's hanging out there and your family comes to you and says, hey, we need some more money. Oh, that's all right. I'll just borrow more. But not just a slight amount more. You rapidly move your debt from $20 trillion federally, but from millions of dollars to increase it by another $1 million. All of a sudden, you no longer can borrow money. The creditors will look at you and say, hey, you've got all this massive credit card debt and you're wanting to take out more loans. You're not even covering what you're making now. And that's the position of the United States. And the only way we get away with it is because the dollar is the de facto currency that people use for international transactions. That might stand unless, except for the fact that we have Russia, China, and others saying, let's not use the dollar anymore. That gives the U.S. too much power and authority. We need to start using alternative currencies. And they've been, for the past decade, been pushing the mechanisms to use alternative currencies. Because if they use the dollar, we have all sorts of control mechanisms that we can watch and monitor and do all sorts of things to these other countries. And they say, hey, we don't want sanctions anymore. We don't want control of our lives and control of... So they're revolting, and they're revolting against the dollar. And the net result of it is that we won't be able to get people to buy our debt, and we'll run out of money.
Yeah. Talk a little bit, Kevin, about what the alternatives might be, because typically people have said, well, yeah, the dollar could be in trouble, but there really isn't any other place for these, you know, aspiring subverters of our status as the world's reserve currency to migrate their funds to, or otherwise engineer, you know, our new world economic order.
Well, China and Russia have been developing alternative mechanisms to create. There is in China a development of a cryptocurrency that is a Chinese-backed cryptocurrency. They've talked about backing it further with gold, and they've developed that system to where you can trade electronically. And if you don't believe that cryptocurrencies are real or potentially lasting, just look what's happened to Bitcoin, where it went from under $10,000 a coin to $37,000, I saw this morning, in a matter of weeks. People are looking for alternatives. This is disruptive technology. It's a time for it. And the U.S. dollar is not considered disruptive technology. It's the old guard, and people are revolting against the old guard.
They certainly are. As we've seen, notably, with the Reddit folks going after the hedge funds on our stock market, it's a prospect, perhaps, of things to come on the global markets as well, as you say. Kevin, let me switch gears, if I can. You led, commendably, an effort to try to help Americans understand the problem with the 2020 elections, called the Every Legal Vote Coalition. And that has now wound down, but there is another question that's pending, and I just wanted to get your thoughts on it, whether Donald Trump should use the coming impeachment trial to lay out the case in a number of the states in which there is evidence of electoral fraud or misconduct or simple errors of various kinds coming together perhaps under the rubric of what I call electoral grand larceny. There's evidence that the president's lawyers don't intend to do that. What say you about whether he should, in fact, go forward with such a strategy?
Well, the lawyers are probably making a correct legal view that the president doesn't need that. His comments don't meet the standards of inciting to riot. He had free speech rights just like every other citizen. He can't be blamed for people breaking into the Capitol, which was criminal behavior and should be denounced. But he can't be blamed for it, especially when it happened before he finished his speech. I mean, there's all this basis. And then you can't remove a sitting president from by impeachment. It's not constitutional, as every expert that I've looked at says. But having said that, this is an opportunity to point out that there were very strange things that happened in this election. The hatred of Donald Trump allowed the media to gloss over, or cause the media to gloss over, all of the anomalies that happened that normally would have been looked at and should be looked at. You can't change election laws at the last minute. You shouldn't change them without the legislature's involvement. We had mass mail-in ballots where normally you would look and reject a good percentage of them. A tiny percentage of them were rejected. They didn't match signatures. They did all kinds of different things in this election than they had in the past. And electronic voting machines, which are not something we've had in our elections for 100 years, they're a more modern phenomena. And before the election, nonpartisan experts pointed out how vulnerable they are. All of a sudden, because it meant Donald Trump leaves the White House, the media is refusing to look into them, and Dominion Systems is threatening to sue anybody who does look into them. I don't know if Dominion Systems, I'm not accusing them of anything other than the fact that they use computers, and computers can be hacked. As every piece of evidence points to, this is not a partisan view, it's a nonpartisan view. You know, whether it's Amy Klobuchar or Elizabeth Warren or Harry Hursty at Kilchang, the documentary on HBO, they've all shown repeatedly that these machines are vulnerable. But all of a sudden in this election, you can't look at that, because if you do, it might mean that Donald Trump stayed in the White House, and we can't have that.
Well, he's not there now, but it's time for the facts to come forward, it seems to me. And this impeachment trial may be the last opportunity evidence has to be properly presented to a national audience, and I pray that President Trump will take advantage of that opportunity. Kevin Freeman, as always, thank you for your time and your expertise and the great work you do at the Economic War Room. I just cannot commend it highly enough to our audience. I hope you'll come back to us again very soon, and the rest of you will do the same again tomorrow. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.